Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the Bank of England will ditch the mortgage affordability stress test. Will it help borrowers or usher in the return of irresponsible lending? As inflation rockets to 9.1%, bad news for your savings, so we'll help you at least find the best rates out there. Better news, though, in the current account market. Is Nationwide's latest offering a sign of the return to proper in-credit interest-paying accounts? Also today, Simon asks, is now the time for investors to be greedy when others are fearful, or should we hang fire? And we tackle troublesome neighbours. Not ours, and thankfully, not literally. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, the Bank of England has announced that it will scrap the current stress test given to those wanting to get a mortgage. Now, the mortgage affordability guidelines were introduced in 2014 to stop irresponsible lenders encouraging us to overstretch ourselves financially. Borrowers have had to prove that they'd still be able to afford their mortgage repayments, even if their rate went up to 3% above their lender's standard variable rate, which at the moment will be around 8%. So what does it all mean? Can literally anyone get a mortgage now? Are we to return, Lee Boyce, to the bad old pre-financial crash days? What's going on? What's happening? When and why?
It's a funny decision, this, Georgia, isn't it? It feels like in the backdrop of everything going on, sky high inflation, base rate going higher, soaring house prices, SVR rates going up very quickly. It all feels like a recipe of, okay, why are they timing this and doing this now? And we touched on this last week on the podcast about the affordability tests that buyers have to go through when they purchase a home. And, you know, the financial crisis and the crash, lots of people got burnt. There was lots of wishy-washy lending going around in which it seemed like you could just turn up at a bank and get a mortgage, potentially, you know, 100% LTV and that kind of thing. A lot of that was stamped out and has been gone away with. You know, the changes that have come into play. You think about it as well, 2014, that was quite a distance after the financial crisis, but it probably shows how long that kind of tail of woe went on for. Now, what this mortgage affordability test is meant to do is meant to see your ability to repay your lender's SVR plus 3%. And I touched on this again last week when I was talking about Barclays, and its SVR is 5.49%, likely to go up a bit higher. That would likely mean, could you afford the mortgage at 8.49%? That's pretty high. That's starting to go pretty high. But when they were doing this this time last year, it would have been more like 7%, 6.5%, 7%, something around that ballpark. Now, they're getting rid of that element. And I think some of the argument about getting rid of that is that, for example, if you're someone that's renting, if you're renting a home and you're making payments of, say, £1,500 or £1,200 as a couple, I'm going to take just a complete example out of it. Let's say £1,500 as a couple. Your ability to have paid that rent back for the last 2 years could potentially count for something when you're going to a lender and the rate that they're offering as the fix is 3% or 3.5% or 4%, and your monthly mortgage payment would be less than the rent. And I think that's what a little element of this is all about. And the government have been keen to try and help first-time buyers more, and especially with the announcements we had fairly recently. And we've had more 95% LTV mortgages come out, for example, because deposit is a massive stumbling block for most people. And it feels like this is just a kind of relaxing of the rules. But banks still have a duty of care. They still have to make sure that what, you know, they don't particularly want you to default on your mortgage. So they've still got to do their own sort of affordability checks, which is what is kind of going on anyway. You know, things factoring things like rising energy prices, when national insurance went up, you know, all those kind of things to make sure that you have enough money coming in to cover your mortgage going forward. And a lot of people, most people wouldn't go onto an SVR and a tracker mortgage when they first buy. They probably get a 2-year fix or a 5-year fix. And I think that's what a lot of the argument is. Now, a lot of the mortgage commentators, you know, brokers have welcomed it. And I can, you know, you can understand that because it potentially means more business for them, and it means potentially helping more first-time buyers through the door. It's something like, I think the Bank of England said 6% of mortgages with this affordability thing would be affected. That's a relatively small part, but it's still worth, at 6%, 30,000 is still quite a high figure in my mind. But the key, the crucial thing is the loan to income ratio is sticking around four and a half times income. Now, that has been lightly tinkered with a few. I'm pretty certain Nationwide tinkered with it and made it 6 times not that long ago. So there's been a little bit of wizardry going around with that test. But it's all about the lender's risk appetite, how much they're willing to take on in terms of that risk, and doing their own due diligence and making sure that, you know. But I think the one thing I'll say, let's get rid of this at this time, it's, it feels like strange timing because of everything that's going on. But I still think that lenders have become more cautious, and I don't think they're all of a sudden going to just completely open the floodgates, you know, pre-2007, and everyone's going to be able to get a mortgage simply. It's just one of some of the elements when it comes to getting a mortgage is being stripped away. And I also think it's sometimes a little bit crazy. Like, people take a 2-year fix out, they go to remortgage, and none of these affordability tests are used anymore because essentially you've made 2 years worth of payments in your mortgage and you've proved you can afford it. So it's kind of like, I think it could help a small section of first-time buyers that are struggling to get a deal.
I agree with you, Lee. I think the timing is a bit odd. And also the loan-to-income limits is a real struggle. It's all well and good, the government guaranteeing these 95% mortgages. Well, not very useful if it's only, you're only allowed 4.5 times your income to get a mortgage. Simon, what do you make of all of this? What are the wider implications for the market, do you reckon, of this?
I think what's interesting is that we talk about this 4.5 times income when actually the FCA moved lenders away from old style income multiple based lending and onto an affordability calculation some years ago after the financial crisis in order to try to prevent things happening again. The loan to income thing is an average. They have to do that across their mortgage book. But that means that they can lend at considerably more than 4.5 times to a reasonable chunk of their borrowers. Because what you have to remember is that there'll be loads of people who borrow who don't come anywhere close to borrowing that much times their income. And that could be joint income as well. It doesn't have to be, you know, individual income. And those could be people who are remortgaging. It could be people who are moving home and have relatively large amounts of equity and relatively small mortgages. So it doesn't stop some people getting supersized mortgages. And if you've got a good credit rating, good employment history, good income kind of thing, you could find that there is a bank or building society willing to lend you 5, 5.5, 6 times. It does seem a bit of a strange move at the moment to remove the stress test. Because after all, the people have been complaining about this for many years, saying that it's unrealistic, saying that, you know, SVR plus 3% is crazy in a low interest rate world where you've got mortgage rates knocking around 1% and then you've got SVRs knocking around 4.5, 5% and then you've got a stress test at 8%. Who's going to go from 1% to 8% and so on? And then all of a sudden, interest rates start rising. They go from 0.1% to 1.25% in the space of 6 months. They're forecast to go all the way up to 3% by the end of the year by the Bank of England itself in its own monetary policy and inflation reports. So you're actually going to see almost that whole 3%. If things happen as people think it is, I'm not so sure it will, you're going to see that whole 3% added to base rate. Mortgage lenders have a tendency to add rises in the base rate to their standard variable rates. They don't have to, of course. They could just keep them where they are. There's no direct link, but they do tend to up it by that much. Not so fast to up the savings rates, but always a bit quicker to up the standard variable rate. So actually, you could conceivably see a scenario where people are coming off the back of 2 or 5 year fixed rate or other length fixed rate deals and going on to an SVR that is actually 3% higher than that SVR previously was. So actually the stress test that everybody has said for years and years is totally unrealistic suddenly actually becomes a realistic scenario. Now, the presumption is that nobody's going to go onto the SVR. We fix, right? You take your 2-year fix, and when your 2-year fix ends, you take another 2-year fix, or you take your 5-year fix, and then you get to wait a bit longer. When your 5-year fix ends, you take another 5-year fix, and so on and so on. But for those of us who've been knocking around the financial journalism world for long enough to remember what happened in the credit crunch, in our version of the credit crunch over here in the UK, which wasn't triggered by exactly the same thing as in America, where they were just dishing out mortgages to anyone who could write their name. And I'm not sure many of those people could write their name. In our version, it involved people thinking that they were always going to be able to remortgage and would never have to pay the SVR. And then all of a sudden, the mortgage market completely froze, and lots of those people ended up locked out of remortgaging and did have to go onto the SVR and pay it. The funny thing about the American version of the credit crunch is you hear this talk of teaser rates. So it's all the problem of teaser rates. Do you know what teaser rates are? They're like 2-year fixes. I mean, that's literally just what a teaser rate is. And they decried this madness where their mortgage market had been totally taken over by people taking these low deals that were fixed for a very short period of time. And then all of a sudden the rate went up. Because actually in America, a lot of mortgages, the rate is fixed for a much longer period. In many other countries, the rate's fixed for a much longer period. Now, the 2-year fix has become much less popular in this country. The 5-year fix, figures from some mortgage brokers show, is now dominating the agenda. But there's still a lot of people taking 2-year fixes. And there is still the possibility that people might suddenly come to the end of those fixes and discover that actually they can't remortgage and they do have to pay the SVR. So maybe the stress test was a good thing. It is worth noting, though, that things have changed in the mortgage market. And amongst all the other things that have changed, there has also been stuff put in place that means that if you are in that position and you speak to your mortgage lender, they should try to help you out by getting you onto a fixed rate with them. Realistically, is this going to open the door to more people buying? Potentially. And it does seem unfair, as Lee said, when you've got people who are paying more in rent than they would on their monthly mortgage payments, but they're prevented from borrowing a mortgage. Is it going to lead to a final leg up for house prices, or have they already turned? Well, that's the big question, isn't it?
And your thoughts are?
My thoughts are that mortgage rates have gone up quite a lot, and that severely crimps people's ability to borrow. I think that is going to start putting a lid on some of the crazier house price inflation that we've seen over the past 2 years. I think it's going to bring house price inflation right back down into more normal numbers. I don't know whether it will lead to house prices falling or not. I tell you what it will do. It will lead to the prices of some houses falling. Not necessarily house prices, but might lead to the prices of some houses falling. The ones that people have been absolutely going all out, gung-ho, all guns blazing, borrow as much money as they possibly can.
£1 million.
To buy that house.
Close to a station, out in the sticks a little
the
bit.
The really in-demand stuff that people have been like, you know, oh, it's not enough, there's a shortage of them, and they've been chasing after them. That's possibly the risky stuff.
Lee, for people thinking, oh, great, this means that, you know, I've got way better chance of getting a mortgage, perhaps. Do you have any tips, though, for perhaps first-time buyers or people wanting to, you know, remortgage to get themselves in the best position financially? Because what, as you said earlier, you know, this is just one test that would have been carried out. Banks look pretty deep, don't they, into your finances?
Georgie, I have no tips because all I've got in my head is teaser rates. Like that. It's just going around in my head. I thought Simon was going to start singing it. No, I've got some tips, really. I don't think this is going to make that big a difference, if I'm being quite frank. And a lot of people are already out there saving for a deposit hard, potentially, and then keep seeing house prices nudging higher. We had the ONS house price index out this week, suggesting that there's been a house price inflation of 12.4% over the last year, which was up from the previous month when we thought it was all slowing down. They're going up again. And I think as a first-time buyer, potential first-time buyer, seeing that is, it can be a little bit disheartening, but you just got to stick with it. And in that meantime, just getting all of your ducks in a row, making sure that you have got a really good credit history, making sure that your credit record is all up to date and doing all of those things that, that you can to prove basically that you will be a good borrower and you will be able to make those monthly payments. And I would just say stick with it. I think the big problem is at the moment that there's a kind of price point underneath a certain price point where, you know, basically there's no stamp duty. You can use things like your lifetime ISA to help with a purchase, that kind of thing, that are just getting snapped up so quickly. It's such a hot market for those kind of price properties, those basically first properties. And to give an example of this, it feels like there's a bit of a kind of a battle between first-time buyers and basically buy-to-let investors again. I've had a letter through the post, just unsolicited, from a local estate agent this week, just saying to the proprietor, you know, put my address down, opened it, and it was saying, why not rent your house out? You know, we have tenants desperate to move in the area. You know, it's a supply and demand issue. I was reading this thinking, well, I only own one house. Where am I going to live? You know, it was what a kind of presumptuous thing. But I think it proves that there's quite a lot of homes in my area, and I live near a train station on the outskirts of London, that are getting snapped up to be let out. And it's kind of like a continuous cycle. And it feels like a bit of a battle between buy-to-let investors and people trying to buy these kinds of ideal property. I'm going to say below sort of £500,000, between that £300,000-£500,000 bracket. And it's that supply and demand issue. It's tricky out there. If it's a good quality property, there's a lot of buyers interested. And for that reason, at the moment, that's why we're still seeing price rises going up, you know, house prices going up. And lack of availability elsewhere. There's a new build estate up the road here, and it's pretty much all sold out already. Quite a lot of plan as well.
Goodness me. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about this much more in the coming months and beyond. But this week, we heard inflation edged up 0.1% to 9.1% in May. Does that mean that it's slowing down? Alas, no. The expectations are still that it will peak above 11% come the autumn. Rubbish for savers. As we know, rates are edging up slowly. The big banks especially have been a little on the tardy side, I think that's fair to say. But might we be able to eke some cash from elsewhere from the banks, namely current account bribes and perks? I'll get onto that in a minute. But first, inflation up. Simon Lambert, 9.1%. Doesn't feel like a 0.1% rise, does it?
Not really. No. I think if you ask most people the impact on their spending power, they wouldn't probably say 9% either. They'd probably say that it feels like a lot more than that. Energy bills, I mean, mine have doubled. Filling up your car, that's going up literally by the day. At the end of this week, it's more expensive than the end of last week. And at the end of last week, it was a whole lot more expensive than at the end of the week before, and so on. People are seeing food prices go up. Even garden furniture apparently is going up. Which is interesting, because this time last year and the year before, it was really hard to get your hands on garden furniture. This year, I think there's actually quite a lot of garden furniture around, but the prices are up quite a bit. I mean, obviously, that's because people are passing on their own prices. Retailers are passing on prices from suppliers, and suppliers are passing on their own higher costs, energy costs, heavily impact, making stuff. Making stuff uses a lot of energy. Transporting stuff uses a lot of fuel. You've got still got disruptions from COVID. I mean, we're all like, COVID? What's COVID? Hey, I seem to remember some COVID thing. But in China, you know, that's still going on in a bad way. They're locking stuff down left, right, and center, you know. So, yeah, it feels like a lot more than that. You can do your own personal inflation calculation. There is a tool to do that. The ONS has a tool to do that. You can look at the basket of goods. You can work out how akin to that basket of goods you think you are. You could go through your spending and you could try to work it out. Whichever way you want to do it, you can probably come up with a number that suits you. And lots of people will say that that number is higher than 9%. But 9% is pretty high anyway. I was asked about this the other day in a conversation. So what's sending inflation up? And my answer was everything.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't think. I mean, there wasn't a lot in that release that wasn't sending inflation up. The question is, how close are we to the peak? The suggestion is in this country that we'll manage to get into double digits, and that actually it might ebb away a bit. The headline figure, you're not going to get any richer. I'm really sorry about this. The headline figure will ease slightly over the summer, and then we're going to get this second bout when the energy price cap rise kicks in, which Wonderfully, we got a warning is probably going to be even higher than we thought this week. So that comes in autumn.
Great.
And that's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, sends inflation into double digits. The hope is then, come the turn of 2023, that it starts to ease. In America, they're hoping that inflation actually is about to reach the kind of point where it peaks and then starts to come down. And in fact, that was why they were freaked out a bit over the last set of inflation numbers there, because they were hoping that they'd seen the peak and it was going to start falling, and it came in higher than expectations.
Lee Boyce, I hear all these news stories day after day after day. If it's not finances, it's political, strike action. We've had a winter of discontent. I don't think any of us were old enough to remember that. But are we heading for a summer into winter, perhaps into the next summer of discontent?
I tell you what, my own personal inflation rates dropped a little bit this week because I've got 100 quid in my back pocket because I couldn't get to work all week. And I was lucky enough to be able to have a job where I could work from home for the week. So, I mean, that's helped.
Swings and roundabouts. I lost about 500 quid on some jobs that I can go into work for. So, you know, it's but then I didn't have to pay 30, 40 quid for a ticket up to London.
I saw a great cartoon. I'm not sure what paper or where it came from this week, where it had a train driver sitting in his cab with his feet up. He had some sign saying, like, you know, up the workers or support the workers. And then he had all the people lined up on the platform going, we are the workers. I mean, this is a really big argument and debate that we don't have time to go into here. And there has been an issue with people's real incomes falling. If you take us to a point some years back, we were on a par with Germany. We're now way behind. There's all these kinds of things. Funnily enough, the Prime Minister said wasn't it going to be a bit volatile because we were shifting to a high wage, high skill economy? And I mean, maybe you could argue, if you want to, and you're on the side of the strikers, that this is part of that shift and all the working practices and stuff like that. As I said, it's a big argument, too deep to go into here. But they're not winning themselves many fans amongst people who rely on transport. And it's a really horrible thing to do to people in the summer where people were, you know, not only is it the work thing, it's the first summer people have actually started to be able mm-hmm. to do stuff and go to events and enjoy things. And they will have spent a lot of money on going to things. And I think the messaging around it, yeah, of like, we are going to cause the maximum disruption. That's just not very nice. I think the messaging, striking isn't nice, but the messaging could maybe have been, we need to do this because we need to like protect our workers and raise our wages, but we are going to try to do it in a way that is fair to people. And this doesn't seem very fair to anybody who doesn't work on the railways.
Simon's there talking about the rail strikes, of course, but then, you know, if anyone goes, well, I don't get the train, it doesn't matter to me, you might be getting a flight on holiday somewhere soon. And just talking about holidays, I'm talking about the fact that stuff is going up in price a lot, petrol prices, boo, doo, 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 doo.
Yeah, I should have. I didn't get to caveat at the end of I got 100 quid in my pocket with the fact that, you know, basically it's been a complete nightmare for like hospitality industry, for example, and people that actually rely on public transport to have to get to the office or have to get to their job. And as Simon says, is that timing? It's a bit nasty. But, you know, at the end of the day, inflation is going up so high. There's going to be lots of different industries in which, you know, workers are going to be looking and asking for much bigger rises than what they've had in recent years. And actually, I had an email come through this week about there's been a massive uptick in people searching for trade unions in their respective industry. And then you start to think, well, who else could strike? As you say, you've got British Airways staff potentially with strike action, rumours of teachers, that's another one that's out there. Can you imagine that, the uproar on that? I mean, you think the train strikes are bad, you've got a teacher strike for a week and you've got children. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like all of these things are finely poised. And as I always say, we don't quite know what's around the corner. But with this sky high inflation, you know, you can kind of understand why people kind of want their wages to go up with inflation, because they're facing much higher bills, including energy.
Indeed. And also, Lee, we got confirmation this week, didn't we, from the Chancellor that the triple lock would return, that the pensioners are in line for a, you know, 10%, if not more, rise next year. You know, if you're a worker, you're thinking, well, what about me?
Well, exactly. And actually, you know, let's not forget that pensions had a very, very rough deal in terms of their uplift. It feels like absolutely ages ago, but it was only a couple of months ago, you know, they scrapped it and didn't pay. There was a lot of pensions that weren't happy about that. And a lot of Conservative voting pensions, I would argue. Bringing it back for the next time round, it still doesn't sit that pretty with people, I don't think. I still believe, Georgia, that I had the right idea with that 5% rise, and I'll still stick with that. It would have been such a more fair, like fairer diplomatic thing to do. But hey ho, perhaps we don't have the chance.
Is this the right move next year, do you think, Lee?
If they don't do it, they're going to be in. I think the government's going to be in severe trouble with pensioners.
How much more trouble can they be?
I know. Well, this is it.
Things are not looking rosy, are they, in the Conservative garden?
Well, no, I don't want to go down too much down the political line.
There's so many debates we can go down, but yeah, sorry.
There is. I think, you know, at the end of the day, the triple lot was promised in the manifesto pledge. And okay, we've had an unusual few years with the pandemic, and now we've got sky high inflation, and it's going to look like a real massive rise potentially. I'm going to be honest, Georgie, I believe it when I see it, but it's what pensions were promised, what they potentially voted for, and so it should rightly come back in.
Apologies, you know, about half an hour ago I started this conversation about savings rates. I mean, I will return there now, but I liked our little detour there because I think it was all very relevant. Yes, savings. We did touch on it, of course, last week when we spoke about the interest rate rise, but you've been digging around, looking around for the best rates at the moment. What have you found? Why is it important to do it?
Well, I tell you what, Georgia, when you mentioned it earlier that banks were being a bit tardy, I mean, that was putting it politely. I could think of other words.
I did see your face there.
Yeah,
I said something wrong, and you were like,
I could think of ruder words beginning with T to describe how banks have treated savers before the base rate hikes and now since. And as I pointed out last week, I mean, Barclays is still paying 0.01% on its easy access. Which when base rate is 0.1% doesn't look as bad as when it's now 1.25%. I mean, the gap is massive, and it puts its SVR rates up every time there's an announcement, and the gap between the two is growing and growing and growing. And for that reason, and as I mentioned last week, it really is now worth moving your money across. Look, when I was saying this time last year or whenever, I meant it, but I really mean it now, because you can improve your rate. There's nothing that's going to beat inflation. There's nothing that's going to get close to beating inflation. And Ed Magnus, bless him, our savings reporter, took the mantle over for this roundup that we do every month. So I'll give you a little insight into This Is Money Towers. We used to write a story every month, X amount of savings accounts now beat inflation, here are the best ones. I got fed up with that story being published every month, so we decided just to make it into a rolling guide. So basically every month when there's a new inflation figure, we just update it. Unfortunately, since Ed has taken it over, there's been no time in which there've been savings accounts that have beaten inflation. So every time now, the guy just gets updated with zero accounts beat inflation, and the gap has just got bigger and bigger and bigger. But if you've got an easy access rate at 0.01% and you can earn 1.56%, you know, that is a pretty big difference, you know, especially depending on how much money you've got. And yes, that is still going to lose money in real terms compared to inflation, but it is still better than nothing.
Do you know what does it for me, Lee? It's not the fact that I'll probably get an extra 5p on my savings. It's sticking it to the banks for the fact that it's like,
it's time
such rubbish.
Really stick it to the banks. Let's stick it to the.
I like that argument, Lee.
Yeah, definitely. And like 2 year fix now, 3%. I mean, that's way better. That's grown like quite a bit. Now, the argument is that fixed rates might continue to rise higher. But I'm sometimes, and you've heard me say this on the podcast before, I'm sometimes the sort of person that just grabs a good rate when I see it, whether it's savings, mortgages, whatever it is, energy. I just go for it because I think, you know, you could sit on your hands and think, oh, there might be a slightly better rate coming on the horizon. And if you are thinking along those lines, you get 1% at 2.6. And there's a raft of good halfway house notice accounts. But whatever you do, let's get out of the big banks. I'm fed up of it. But, you know, we're going to talk about the Nationwide deal next, aren't we? So I'll just shoehorn this in now, I think. So Nationwide has relaunched its 5% rate on the first year of its current account. There's some pretty big caveats to that, only up to £1,500. So it's not exactly like big life-changing balances you can put in there.
Yeah.
But it's also offering a switching bonus, and you could overall end up with 200 quid if you max that out. If you keep 1500 quid and you stick to the terms and conditions, make the payments that need to go in there.
Pretty decent.
It's good. I mean, 5%, especially if you're someone with just a small balance and you're looking to like grow it and you're looking to potentially move current account and make a bit of cash. Nationwide has cleaned up in the last decade with the current account switching service. I mean, it's been the number one switch to bank building society from those figures. And a lot of big banks have bled out customers through the switching. But that is where the battle is at the moment. So if you think about it like this, savings terms, savings rates, it's all been dominated by challenger banks, small providers chasing that money, largely in fixed rates because they know when the money's going, they know when they've got to pay out the interest, that kind of thing. Easy access, a bit more temperamental. You've probably heard me say this before. But in terms of the current account space, that is where banks are actually competing a bit. You know, there are still bribes to be had there in terms of cash for switching. And other little bits and pieces, including this 5% from Nationwide. There's a good rate on offer from Virgin, from Chase. They're offering rates linked to current accounts because they want you to open a current account. And that's the way it goes. The only thing is, I'll say that Nationwide one, I quite like having my savings segregated in a separate thing. And if you're going to use this as a main account, it gets a little bit confusing trying to kind of keep the right sum in there and that kind of thing. And what I like to do, this is a little tip that I have. I always have a second bank account. I always have done, especially when I first started working at This Is Money, there were a number of IT meltdowns. And I always think, well, have a little bit of cash in a second account. And then, you know, the likelihood of both banks being down on the same day is probably quite low. So I've got a secondary account. I use it for saving for like a holiday. So I put all my holiday money in it recently, fee free with Starling. So that's what I'm with. But I could be tempted in to use that secondary current account to switch to get the bribe. So I've got my main bank account. I'm doing nothing with it other than get my wages paid in and all of the other bits and pieces. I've got a second account. I could switch away from Starling and go and switch to Nationwide, meet its terms and conditions, that is, put £1,000 in a month, all of the other little hoops you have to jump, which aren't many. And then I could just bank that 200 quid as long as I stick to the rules. And then I could repeat the process all over again with another bank once I've done that after a year. So you're not doing anything with your main account. All of your direct debits and stuff are there. You might need to set up one or two direct debits from your secondary account, but it's not a problem. We've all got lots of direct debits and things that come in and out of accounts. It's not really that difficult. After a year, switch for another good cash bribe, and just keep repeating the process. And then you never have to worry about anything going wrong with your main account.
That's true. Lee, don't say I don't never listen to you. I did the same about the double bank as well. I got fed up with it. Oh, and it's just nice having, you know, you say you like having your savings separate from your main spending. I also like having my discretionary spending, you know, the coffee shops and the, you know, the beers and stuff, and on a separate card that I can just go and use, and that's my fun money, and you know, it just it helps me.
Yeah, it's a good way of budgeting,
and it's a security.
You know, yeah, you know, you could stick 100 quid at the start of the month and say, do you know what, this is my having fun money or whatever it is amount of money in there. You just switch across on payday, and you know that's your budget. And I do that sometimes, George, as well. I quite like it. I quite like that.
I like the fact that my having fun money is coffee.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much fun there is to be having coffee.
Well, it's fun for everyone else, trust me.
It brings me joy. It does. I'm going to, after this podcast is recorded, I'm going to take a walk down to my local coffee shop, support the local business, have a coffee, have a chat with the owners, and that is fun. It brings me joy.
There you go. Simon, when big banks are offering basically sod all with savings, insult accounts, I think you call them, why are they seemingly so generous, some of them, especially the big ones, with current accounts? You know, switching bribes, in credit interest. Why are they doing that?
Because they can limit the amount of money that they're paying that interest on. So, you know, for example, you'll have a cap on what can earn that level of interest. Because realistically, if you're bunging someone 100 quid to join, that's the cost of customer acquisition. That's what that gets squared off as. And then you look at the lifetime value of that customer, and the lifetime value of that customer is considerably more than the £100. So you try to get them in. Obviously, there's then the issue of churn. So you get people in and then they leave, and then they skip off to get their £100 bribe from someone else, and so on and so on. But realistically, Current accounts aren't really a big churn product. A lot of us stick with them for a very long time. That's why we've got the current account switching service. That's why there was the whole big push to get people to switch current accounts some years ago, and so on and so on. I think the sweet spot is trying to find the combination of, can you get paid to join? Can you get paid interest? Can you get a bank account that actually works really well for you? And I think I'm more interested at the moment in some of the stuff that some of the bank accounts can do around, you know, sorting your money into different pots, labeling your transactions so that you get, when you go through your banking, you're like, right, that's what that money was. I paid that money to that person for that, rather than going, and it amazes me how few of the big banks' apps allow you to do that yet. That's my next stage on my banking adventure in life.
That sounds fun, Simon.
I haven't done anything about it. It's not that much of an adventure that I've actually got around to doing it, but I'm going to try to test out a few of these things, try to work out how well they work and if it's really worth it. But like most people, I've got massive inertia and haven't got around to doing it. And there's the whole, I'm going to have to switch on my direct debits and everything. That's such a pain.
Yeah.
Interestingly though, because I wanted to know whether you could use the current account switching service to do all that direct debit stuff and move things if you were already a customer of that bank, but you weren't using it as your main current account. So could you then ship your main current account over to it with them doing all the work, even if you're already a customer, or do you have to be a new customer? And I think the answer is that you can get your new bank to ship all that stuff over, even if you are already a customer of it. Like, you've just got an account, say for example, with a Starling account,
yeah,
and you just got it to do overseas spending, but now you think, I'm going to try and move my joint current account over to it, but how am I going to make that work?
Lee?
Starling doesn't offer anything though, does it? There's no bonuses ever.
I moved to Starling. I was about to say, I moved to Starling, doesn't offer that. But what it has done recently, I noticed, is you're talking about the knowing where you spend. It's got a lot more categories, which are really interesting. It's very colourful and a little diagram, but I haven't seemed to marry up the visualisation of how I'm spending to then not spend on the things that perhaps I shouldn't be, the treats and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I definitely would be someone like that, I think, Georgia. I mean, it all looks nice and everything, but I don't think it would influence any of my consumer behaviour. I'm not sure. Maybe.
I live in hope. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly update on the markets. Sam, what have we had going on this week?
Well, following such a busy and chaotic week last week, we were due a more quiet one, and that's pretty much what we got. From a UK perspective, we had inflation, which I'm sure many people would have seen and heard about. It came out at a 40-year high. The silver lining of that was the core inflation number, which takes out the volatile prices such as petrol, etc. Well, that was actually a little bit lower than expected. So this helps us short term move further away from that stagflation narrative. There's a lot of data out before the next meeting, 4th of August for Bank of England, so we'll keep an eye on that. But overall, markets have moved higher, the ground higher this week, which has been needed.
And what do we have on the agenda for next week?
Well, on the face of it, just checking through the calendar and so on, it looks pretty quiet again. We have UK GDP out, but that's a final reading, so we won't be expecting any surprises there. There's some mortgage approvals and lending data on Friday, which some participants will find useful when looking at the housing market. But one thing I would note is that next week is the last week of the month, it's the last week of the quarter, and the last week of the first half of the year. So usually this means markets might be quite tricky to navigate. That could be because of month-end flows, portfolio rebalancing ahead of the new quarter, and so on. So yeah, just worth noting that. And of course, on Friday as well, it's likely to be quieter than usual due to it being the last sort of day before Independence Day on the Monday. So some people will take that Friday off and have a long weekend. But look, another quiet week wouldn't be the worst thing for markets if this week is anything to go by.
Well, we've certainly had plenty of noisy ones in the past. So yes, a few quiet weeks where things move higher would be nice.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us, Sam. We'll speak to you next week.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. A new era of high inflation and rising rates is hammering investors. But, asked Simon Lambert, is it time to be greedy when others are fearful? Yet. Simon, we touched on this last week, and clearly last week wasn't the time because you've been pondering it this week. So is now the right time, or do we hold fire for a little bit longer?
Right now. Actually, you missed it 3 minutes ago while we were podcasting. You could have been a trading millionaire, Georgie, and you've missed it now. Sorry.
Oh, well, never mind.
You know, life moves on. This is a question that's going to run and run, because whilst the FTSE 100 until very recently was broadly flat for the year, it's now down about 5% after some falls in over the past week. The S&P 500, the world's most important stock market, is down more than 20%. It's in a bear market. Go digging in your portfolio, though, if you hold some individual shares or investment trusts, funds, etc., and you're likely to find some stuff that's down by quite a lot more. Down by the kind of scary numbers that qualifies for full-on stock market crash. Stock market crash that's very different to the COVID one, where everything just went down in a straight line, but very, very quickly, and then went quite a lot of stuff went back up very quickly as well. Some other stuff ended up in the doldrums. This time round, if you look at the FTSE 100's top fallers over the past 6 months, there's some scary looking figures. Ocado down 48%. Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust down 48%. Royal Mail down 46%. JD Sports down 45%. Ashtead down 45%. Hargreaves Lansdown down 42%. And so on. Now, the interesting thing about these companies is that whilst they might have been companies that did very well in terms of share price performance in recent years, they're not the kind of slightly basket case, massive jam tomorrow, blue sky thinking stocks that the bull market was classified as being all about. But these are proper, pretty well-run businesses. And okay, yes, Ocado, maybe investors have got well ahead of themselves on the whole Ocado was a tech company rather than a grocery delivery company and so on, and it's been hampered by the fact that it's just said it needs to raise more money. But 48% share price fall, that's quite a big one. But if you look at something that's much less speculative than that, Royal Mail, for example. Royal Mail, the whole thing about that was the parcel stuff. You know, there is a parcels boom. It plays into Royal Mail's hands. Royal Mail shares have managed to get chased up on the back of that. A 46% fall in 6 months for something where the underlying case for investing in it probably still remains. I think we're going to still keep getting stuff delivered to our door at an increasing rate. You know, Hargreaves Lansdown, again, very well-run business, very profitable, very high margin. Ashtead has been a share price winner for investors for years and years and years. It does materials higher in the US. There's all different things driving down, you know, the share prices of individual companies. And if you look, but some of them, the underlying stuff underneath it, the underlying business still looks pretty good. So you do start to question, well, have they fallen too far? Again, in the US, you've got some very big name companies that have fallen by a lot. Amazon shares down 36% since the start of the year. Meta, aka Facebook, down 52%. Apple down 25%. Google parent Alphabet down 23%. And those aren't even the real speculative ones. Some of those have taken an even bigger pasting. Shopify down 72%. Ginkgo Bioworks also down 72%. Netflix down 70%. Question is, as you said, is it time to be greedy when others are fearful? Is it time to adopt the Warren Buffett mantra? I think the difficulty here and the difficulty for investors is that while it's possible to unpick what's going on and to say that the pendulum always swings too far in terms of stuff going up and also when stuff goes down, we're in a very different world to the one that investors, businesses, and consumers have been operating in for the last, you know, decade and a half. And that's causing a major headache for people because they're looking at these companies and going, well, what is the price I'm willing to pay for that kind of company now? There's this, what gets referred to as price discovery is going on. And price discovery involves people going, I mean, I don't know. Like what is it worth? Like the world's been turned on its head. How do I work it out? Everything I used to work that out, price discovery, has just gone completely upside down. Central banks now, they don't have your back in the stock market. They don't necessarily have your back on your mortgage, as we were talking about earlier. They're much more concerned about fighting inflation by rapidly raising interest rates. So in this brave new world, it's quite a lot harder to work things out. But you know, there are some fund managers out there. We touched on this last week, saying, look, there's some really good businesses who are being the baby's gone out with the bathwater here. And there is maybe some opportunities for investors. But I think it's clearly not a time to be gung-ho and don't just buy stuff that went down because it went down, it should go back up. And be very careful about trying to time the market. Remember, investing is a long-term game. But maybe even if markets do continue to fall from here, we might be at a point where stuff is starting to look worth putting some money into. Who knows? Could be completely wrong, and they could tumble by another 30% from now.
Lee Boyce, easy one for you. Crypto. Now a good time to get involved?
Oh, Georgie, you're landing me in it today, aren't you? Crypto, is it a summer of discontent? Blimey, these are massive
big questions. Yeah, big questions, Lee.
I'm going to be very diplomatic in my response, Georgie.
Why?
That's what we do on this podcast.
All right, sorry.
look, it's no secret that cryptocurrencies and people that have been in cryptocurrencies potentially investing when it went quite high not so long ago have been burnt. In recent weeks with things going on, there's been a sell-off everywhere. You know, it's not just crypto, it's been big stocks, as Simon was just saying. And you know, people will be doing that thing where buying the dip, you know, all of that. And it's like, do you buy the dip? Is it a dip? Could it go any lower? Do I have a crystal ball? No. I personally, Georgie, would be very, very, very careful, as I would have always recommended over the years in which we've talked about crypto. If you're going to get involved, if you are going to get involved, know what on earth it is and which crypto that you're getting involved in, what it does, read the white paper, all of those kind of things still apply. But I think it would take quite a brave person to be thinking about getting involved in crypto at the moment.
Even reading all the monthly, and like, I'm not going to pretend that I've read all the bump, but even if you've read it all, that still doesn't account for what the heck is going on at times with crypto.
Yeah, it's volatile, and it has been a volatile. But as I say, there's volatility everywhere at the moment. You know, it's not just cryptocurrencies. I'm not going to sit here and start bad-mouthing the whole crypto industry because I'm being diplomatic. But it's kind of like... It's one of those things where, you know, a lot of people would have got involved at, say, Bitcoin between somewhere $1,000 to $5,000. Then over the years, seeing it go up to that peak of $60,000, you'll have a lot of winners, but you'll have a hell of a lot of losers as well at the same time. And for me, I don't think about crypto so much as investing. It's more like speculating, in my opinion, unless you really, really, really know what you're doing and what it's all about. I think a lot of people just try to piggyback and make quick gains. And that's not what investing is about. You know, as we always say, it should be a 5 to 10 year outlook. And crypto is such a new industry in which I would argue that a vast majority don't probably understand that well. And then I've tried to kind of get rich quick, you know, hearing the stories of turning £1,000 into £100,000 and all that kind of thing. I think the boat might have sailed for all of that kind of level of stuff. And then, you know, we're talking, I remember reading sort of the tail end of last year, and again, those outrageously, you know, predictions of it's going to be Bitcoin's going to be $100,000, Bitcoin's going to be $1 million, you know, a coin, all of that kind of stuff. You just got to take it all with a pinch of salt. There's a lot of noise. And the noise sort of quietens down a little bit when there's a bit of a dip. If it's going to go back up again, you sure enough know that there will be 1,001 people saying, buy crypto now. You know, this is the opportune time. So that's my view, Georgie.
It's very hard, though, to have a completely clear view about this area. I mean, indeed, in investing, but there are many people who are heavily invested.
They're hodling.
Financially, but also kind of emotionally. It's a movement. Well, it's a religion in some areas.
It might be an investing lesson for some people, you know, and knowing whether to cash out, you know, making a decision that, okay, you made a loss, you got a bit burnt, but are your losses going to get any bigger? You know, did you have a stop loss in terms of this is as low as I will let it go? But I think there's a lot of people just hodling, basically holding on for dear life in terms of might have got involved quite a long time ago and are sitting on paper gains, seeing the gains on the app. But then we're seeing, you know, some kind of worrying rumors and things going around about some certain platforms and apps and all that kind of stuff. And it makes people a bit itchy, it makes people a bit nervy and start going, actually, I might cash out. And that's what we've seen with a couple of the platforms. People have been selling out so fast. There's been some problems. So yeah, it's a real roller coaster, you know, as opposed to what investing should be about, and about that long-term sensible choices.
Goodness, we've touched on so many different subjects that we could have a whole podcast about, but we don't have time. One more to leave us with, though, a reader question. We haven't had one of those in a couple of weeks. I live, not me personally, this is the reader, obviously. I live in an end terrace house and my neighbour owns the garden to the side and wants to build another house there, right up against my side walls, so that my house becomes mid-terraced. This will mean my house will fall in value by about 15% and the building works will be a nightmare since we work from home. Can Simon Lambert, they do anything to stop it?
Yes and no. So here's an interesting one. So interesting that it went absolutely bananas for people reading it when we published it this week. You would think, wouldn't you, that someone turning your end of terrace home into a mid-terrace would be just an outright, not going to happen. They're not going to be allowed to do that. And that you wouldn't need to worry about it because it's so out there. Turns out, no, that's not the case. So we have an answer from our expert, Martin Gain, a chartered town planner. And he has explained that a landowner is generally entitled to develop their own property, and there is little in the planning system to protect neighbours' house prices or to protect them from building noise and hassle. The Party Wall Act allows neighbours to build up to their boundary. So you should first work out whether your neighbour owns all of the land right up to your side wall. So if your sidewall stops before the boundary and then there's a small gap and that gap's on your land, they can't build on that. But if the sidewall of your house straddles the boundary, i.e. it's half owned by you and half by them, they are entitled to use that wall as part of their build. And if your sidewall is on your land but sits right next to the boundary, they can build the house right up against it. The Party Wall Act requires they serve a notice on you and you can employ surveyors at their expense to ensure the plans won't damage your property, but you can't use it to stop the works entirely. Now, the neighbour will need planning permission for the development. And it's really important in something like this that you make your representations. Download and read the plans carefully. Seek advice from the case officer if there's anything you don't understand. Seek the support of your local councillors if you feel your concerns are not being heard. And make a very considered and careful response. Planners are concerned about whether a new development harms the area in terms of harming its character and appearance, parking problems, doesn't harm neighbours in terms of a loss of light or privacy, but the impact on your value and like property's value, that's not taken into account. Okay, so you need to argue this from the point of view of, are there, for example, are there only small terraces of houses or semi-detached houses, and does this create a terraced effect that doesn't occur anywhere else in the local area? Could that detract from the area? Could it detract from your privacy? I mean, obviously, if you had a window in your sidewall, they're not going to be able to build over that. Could it change the character of the area? Could it be overdevelopment? All of these other things. You need to have a look through the things that you can use to object. Maybe you need to corral objections from neighbours as well and get them to object. But also you can try to influence, if it does happen, how it happens. You could try to get some conditions put in there. Things like the design, making sure that it matches other houses nearby or along the terrace, landscaping, parking, control how the development takes place, i.e. you could try to limit the building works to certain times and things like this. I mean, the thing is, if someone gets planning permission for something like that, the build's not going to be straightforward and it is going to impose on you. And that does happen all the time. And this leads to major disputes between neighbours. And it must be said, even in areas where planning appears to be quite strict, and this is an interesting thing, you will get neighbouring districts where planning is much stricter than in the other one. I know this locally in the area that I now live, which is the same area that I grew up in many years ago. If you go across into one council's patch, people seem to get away with a hell of a lot more than they do in the patch that I live in. And that's been the case for years and years and years. But even within there, stuff will get through and you look at it and you're like, how did they agree to that? Surely they would have turned it down. But don't let it be that you just thought it would get turned down and you didn't object and you didn't make your representations. And then all of a sudden it's passed. Because once it's passed, it's done. You can't do anything about it. So yeah, there you go. They could build against your wall and turn you into a mid-terrace.
Oh, neighbourly disputes. Anyway, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.